McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased to be able to welcome back to our studios today, well, not to our studios, to the program, someday to our studios, but today via Zoom, Dr. Stephanie Mitchell, who is professor of history at Carthage College. She has been on the program a couple of different times, I think most recently, to talk about a really marvelous event that occurred a couple of summers ago, which explored women's suffrage movements in other countries in the Western Hemisphere, I mean outside of the United States, and tracing some of the ways in which women gained the right to vote in places like Mexico and Brazil and Argentina and so on. Professor Mitchell is joining us today on the morning show because of an interest that she has had for some time on various issues related to immigration, and particularly to the experience of undocumented aliens in our country, undocumented immigrants. And specifically today, she would like to talk about a matter related to undocumented immigrants and driving, and the possibility that Wisconsin might be in a position to issue what would amount to driver's licenses under sort of the special circumstances that undocumented immigrants find themselves. She would like to talk about this today, and actually with Professor Mitchell are two students who have also had concerns about this and have worked on this particular issue. Petula Walsh Grant, who is a junior psychology and history major at Carthage, and Kaya Martin, who is a sophomore criminal justice and political science major at Carthage. And so we're going to be getting some helpful information from all three of them, and we welcome you to the morning show. Glad you're here. Professor Mitchell, before we begin this more specific, focused conversation, maybe you could give our listeners a bit of a sense of how and why, under what circumstances, you have become so devoted to this particular issue, I mean the overall issue of immigration and undocumented immigrants in particular. Where did this start for you?
Well, sure. I guess I've been close to the immigrant community ever since I moved back to the United States. I am a Latin Americanist historian by training, and I lived for a long time in Latin America. And so it sort of made sense for me to be close to the immigrant community from Latin America when I moved back to the United States, which I did to come and teach at Carthage 18 years ago now. But I didn't necessarily become as involved in work supporting immigrants and the particular trials that immigrants face in this country, really until the migration crisis began fewer than 18 years ago. I don't know if you recall, under the Obama administration was the first wave of undocumented minors, unaccompanied and undocumented minors flooding north. And that's really when I became interested. And then, of course, with the terrific crisis of the mass incarceration of asylum seekers in 2018 and 2019, I felt that I had to become much more involved. It was a crisis that hit home when our Kenosha Detention Center began housing large numbers of these asylum seekers.
Give us some sense, that is, give our listeners some sense of the kind of work that you have done. I mean, what have been some of the avenues through which you've been doing this work and trying to make a difference?
Thank you for asking, because I'm really excited to talk about the work that our two Wisdom affiliates do here locally. I'm a member of the Racine Interfaith Coalition, which we call RIC for short. And in Kenosha, the name of the chapter is CUSH, Congregations United to Serve Humanity. Those are two chapters of the statewide organization called Wisdom. And most of the Wisdom chapters statewide have immigration task forces that work on issues around immigration justice. And so almost all of my advocacy goes through those organizations, and I'm very proud. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America that Carthage is affiliated also has a really robust apparatus for supporting immigration justice issues, and I work through that institution as well.
Very good. I want to ask the same question, or roughly the same question, to the two students that are joining us as well, Petula Walsh-Grant and Kaya Martin. Let's go in that order for no particular reason. Petula Walsh-Grant, again, you're a junior psychology and history major at Carthage. Tell us under what circumstances this issue has become so important to you.
So I originally did high school debate, actually, and it's kind of where I got introduced to the topic of immigration. It affects so many different sectors of society, and it's so important that the community outreach is proportional to the needs of the undocumented immigrant community. And unfortunately, that hasn't always been the case. So I've always kind of been passionate about that since that time when I was introduced to these issues and all the different layers of society and all the different ways it affects people. However, I only just started to jump on the chance to actually make an impact when Dr. Mitchell invited me to speak about this topic on air and also be a little bit more involved in the immigration clinic she is helping to coordinate.
So you've had this concern for some time, but now you're kind of entering this new phase where you're actually with your feet on the ground trying to make a difference with this issue. Very good.
Yes.
Kaya Martin, sophomore criminal justice and political science major. Tell us what draws you to this this issue.
Yeah, I actually am one of the students that chose my major when I got on campus. I only chose to go into political science and criminal justice because I joined a great club on campus called Phi Alpha Delta, which is a pre-law club. And part of Phi Alpha Delta's, just part of our club, is we do an outreach program, and we worked at the ECLA legal clinic, where we basically got to shadow for free legal advice. And a lot of the cases that would come in that I got to shadow were about immigration. And it started to really, I started to have a lot of feelings about it and started to feel like these people will need some help. Like, it's just such an issue that's not talked about enough. And then we also do a clinic legal training for an introduction to an immigration law course. And I took that this semester, and I got really interested in everything. So I've, again, kind of like Petula, I'm now starting to put my feet on the ground and do some stuff with it. But it's been a lot of training for the last semester for me.
I imagine that for you, this, your understanding of this issue changed when you started to actually see individual human beings and seeing, as they say, up close and personal, the impact
Absolutely.
That this was having on their lives, and to be in a position to do something about it would be great. For those of you just joining us, my guests today on the morning show are Dr. Stephanie Mitchell, professor of history at Carthage College, and two students that are working with her on some important issues related to immigration, Petula Walsh Grant and Kaya Martin. And very specifically, we want to focus most of our attention today on the matter of something that, as Professor Mitchell might have already said, that is sometimes referred to as driver cards. And this touches on a reality that is of very difficult complication for the typical undocumented immigrant. So, Professor Mitchell, let's kind of start with the problem and maybe start with its root. So tell us what the issue has been for undocumented immigrants in the United States related to being permitted to drive, and at what point when things changed in a way that made this very, very difficult for them.
Sure, thank you. I'm really grateful to you for asking the question. To be perfectly honest, it is very frustrating to see the amount of misinformation and disinformation about immigration that gets peddled in this country today, often for pretty crude and narrow political purposes. People often don't understand the things that are broken about our immigration system. We talk about having a broken immigration system, but until you were really willing to dedicate the time to learn about it, it's not always clear for people who are outside the system the ways that it are broken, the ways that it is broken. So I'll just begin with, you know, some basic information that people who are undocumented in Wisconsin, it's generally speaking not because they failed to, quote, get in line, which is a phrase that you hear, you know, why don't you just do it legally? Our immigration system doesn't provide visas for most people, and certainly the people that live in Wisconsin and are our neighbors, most of whom have been here for more than 10 years and have families and are fully integrated into our communities, would do almost anything to obtain a visa. But there are not visas that are available. And even for the very few people who are eligible to receive a visa, who have, you know, a complete legal route to immigrate to the United States, very often those visas are almost imaginary, because the waits for the visas to become available can be 50 years or 80 years or 100 years, right? They're impractical, right? So this is a problem that is only a small part about driving. It's really a problem about the whole immigration system and the way that the United States fails to welcome people, even people who have been here for a very long time and would do almost anything to be able to migrate legally to the United States. So that's the population that we're talking about in Wisconsin. It's tens of thousands of our neighbors who, prior to the passage of the Real ID Act in 2005, were eligible to get a driver's license in Wisconsin. So your driver's license was not necessarily tied to your immigration status. But after the passage of the Real ID Act, and particularly after 2007, when the Real ID Act became implemented in Wisconsin, our driver's license became federal IDs, which means that you have to have a Social Security card and a Social Security number in order to procure a driver's license. That, in a sense, tied driving to your immigration status. And that meant that if you were not able to, you know, procure a visa and to have legal status in the country, you also couldn't get a driver's license, which has created a host of problems, and not just for migrants in our community. And Ms. Walsh Grant and Ms. Martin are going to talk about some of those problems that act created for all of us. But I just want to point out that the law doesn't require the states to only issue licenses that are real IDs. States are also empowered by the legislation to issue licenses that do not serve as federal identification. So the governor has introduced in his budget a solution to the problem, which would be for Wisconsin to do the way that many other states do, including Illinois, which is to create a driver's license for undocumented Wisconsinites that is not a federal ID. So that driver's license would not be useful for things that are against the law, like voting, for example. This is something that people often talk about. Oh no, if undocumented migrants get driver's licenses, then they'll be able to vote. Voting when you are not a citizen is a very serious crime with very serious penalties. And everybody knows that. And no one is proposing that driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants ought to serve as an ID in that capacity. But it would serve as an ID in many other capacities that our students are gonna talk about. It would allow you to go to the pharmacy and buy your prescription that your doctor's ordered, for example. It would allow the police to ask for an identification if they need to stop you for some reason. And it would make a whole host of other things much, much easier. So that's the governor's solution. And that's why we wanted to come and talk about it today, to try and clarify what this solution is and what it isn't. And I'm just so happy to have the opportunity to talk about it. So thank you very much.
It's important. Let's begin actually with Petula Walsh Grant, again, a junior psychology history major at Carthage. I know that one of the things that you have been studying specifically are some of the public safety ramifications of this. And I suspect that this is one angle that the typical citizen isn't really thinking about very much. In what way is public safety endangered in the current system, and in what ways would public safety be enhanced were this proposal by the governor to be enacted?
So under the current system, people who are unlicensed and undocumented don't necessarily have the option to become licensed through state procedures. However, by passing legislation or by allowing individuals who are undocumented to get their licenses, we could promote better roads, safer roads, and improve relationships with local law enforcement, which would promote public safety on the whole. So according to a study by AAA, unlicensed drivers are almost 5 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than licensed drivers. Unfortunately, when people don't pass these driving exams and vision tests, we end up with a significant increase in fatal incidents, which obviously we would all like to decrease to promote better public safety and better roads. By making sure all Wisconsin drivers are adhering to state standards regarding driving, we can improve how safe our roads are for all drivers. And this can even expand to fewer hit and run incidents. We can see this by the California passing its driver's law, which is similar to the one that is being proposed currently in 2015, after which the state experienced a 10% decline in hit and run accidents. So when people don't have this visceral fear of being running into these incidents with law enforcement because they don't have proper identification, we can see that they're a lot less likely to leave the scene of the accident, which promotes better public safety for everyone, and which encourages people to feel more comfortable calling 911 and reaching proper law enforcement after such a dangerous incident. We can also see that by having these licensing options, we can increase trust and cooperation with local law enforcement, because having a valid driver's license increases people's willingness to report these types of incidents and report crimes on the road. It can also really help public first responders and health professionals respond a lot faster after an incident like this or an accident, because we can identify those victims who are involved or any individuals involved in these kinds of accidents. So it's very important that we promote this type of licensing, because it allows for a lot better public safety and a lot better relationships within the community, promoting health and law enforcement, and making sure everybody's able to do their job effectively. It's a really bipartisan issue that people don't necessarily think it is, because promoting the health of the community is always an issue for both sides, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum. Right. Having this licensing option can also improve our national security, because According to top security experts, it's significantly counterproductive to deny identification documents to immigrants because it negatively impacts the ability of law enforcement to identify individuals when those incidents do occur. It's really helpful to have that kind of database, so when issues do occur on the road or in general, they're able to respond a lot faster and identify anyone involved a lot faster than they would otherwise. Without this type of identification, we don't have that database that's available, which could really end up helping a lot public safety and improving our roads and our lives on a daily basis.
Professor Mitchell, anything you want to add to any Ms. Walsh Grant just said?
How about a resounding amen? And I'll just point out, I really want to underscore what she said about this not being a partisan issue. Our governor and our local sheriff in Kenosha run on different party tickets, but they are absolutely on the same page about this. And it's because of the public safety angle, and our Kenosha sheriff has been gracious enough to write an open letter to the legislature asking that they support this initiative because it is such an important public safety measure.
Right. Otherwise, we have unlicensed drivers who have not gone through any of the rigors that typically occur when somebody secures what we think of as a driver's license, even so much as undergoing the vision test that is essential. I mean, they fly completely under the radar and then are on the roads, and in a sense, we don't even know they're on the roads. We don't have any record whatsoever of that. So this is a means to address that, and because our roads are such a public venue for all of us, it's something that impacts all of us, not just undocumented immigrants.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
Kaya Martin, sophomore criminal justice and political science major, I know that you want to speak to some other aspects in which our community overall and actually some financial implications are part of this.
Absolutely. So I'm going to get to the financial one. I think that the community benefits are so important because the dehumanization of undocumented people is so easy in our political climate, in our current world, and in our debates even. It's incredibly important to remember that undocumented people are members of our communities. They're our neighbors, they're our friends, they're people we know. And driver's license for undocumented people can have so many more impacts than just financial or legal. And it's important to also focus on their community benefits and not just the financial ones. But some community benefits that we can get from people having driver's license would be increased educational support and enrichment. Parents are more likely to want to go meet with the teachers, counselors, administrators, and children will be more likely to participate in after-school enrichment activities that require transportation. Otherwise, they would be probably a little turned off from these activities because their parents would have to go drive them, and that would just cause a new anxiety. And that leads into also reduced school absences and reduced stress for children. Children of undocumented parents will no longer be afraid to have a parent drive them to school if they are late or miss the bus or need some ride to an after-school activity. And eliminating the stress of worrying about a parent's safety can also lessen the potential for behavioral and mental health problems in children of undocumented parents. So this also leads to healthier families. Individuals will not hesitate to go to the doctor to pick up a prescription or get preventative care for themselves or their children if they have proper identification and do not have to fear being detained for unlicensed driving. So this increases community involvement as well. Many immigrants are already strong contributors to our community, but with driver's cards, more individuals might be able to contribute their time and talent to help our community thrive. So this is important because they can make a better impact on our communities if we just give them the tool to be able to drive with a driver's license. Some financial impacts are also pretty good. So we have positive financial impact on Wisconsin. Because insurance and automotive industries have lost the business of thousands of immigrants who no longer have licenses. And the state DMV has lost the financial contribution of people who are now denied access to its services. If 28,000 potentially unlicensed drivers in the state applied for and are granted driver's licenses, the state will receive at least $2 million in additional license revenue. Hmm. So this additional revenue may also result from increased auto registrations. These are very important for the public safety aspect, but also giving Wisconsin some state revenue. This also can contribute to lower insurance premiums for everyone, because insurance companies will have more customers and will pay fewer claims for uninsured drivers, meaning that premiums could be reduced for everyone overall in the community. This contributes to economic growth. Individuals will be able to travel to jobs where they are needed, and businesses that have held off expanding due to lack of workers, they'll be more likely to find the employees they need. This is important in rural areas like Wisconsin, where immigrants fill jobs on farms, factories, and construction. And finally, this is a reduced backlog for law enforcement and the courts. So this is another reason that this is a bipartisan issue, because both sides can find part of this that would help law enforcement, it would help courts. Reducing the large number of cases related to driving without a license can reduce a language interpreter, can reduce court costs, and allow judges and law enforcement to spend their time on more serious priorities in eliminating black backlogs. So these are very important financial contributions and community benefits that can come from immigrants having driver's cards. Hmm.
Professor Mitchell, anything to add to that long list?
Oh, it's a long list. I think maybe we should just slow it down and replay it, because it's each one of these points is so important. So I'm just going to say thank you, that all of that is very accurate and very important. And when you really stop to think about each one of the pieces that she talked about, the impact on children, the impact on families, the impact on state revenue, then you just start wondering, why on earth haven't we solved this problem before now?
I don't remember if we've touched on this yet, but quite often when this kind of thing is discussed, it is called a driver's card rather than a driver's license. But what Governor Evers is proposing, I understand, would call this actually a driver's license. So maybe you just want to say a word about the terminology and maybe clarify again what this would be, the ways in which this would be a standard driver's license, but the ways in which it would not be.
Sure, I'm happy to. So the governor is calling this driver's licenses for undocumented Wisconsinites, and it's just a regular driver's license. The only thing to understand is that it is not going to be a federal ID. So it's not a real ID. If anybody has been to the DMV since the passage of the law to renew your license and get that real ID, you know that that's a real onerous process. It took me months to find all the different documents. I didn't have an original copy of my birth certificate, so I had to go back to Florida to find it. And the driver's license for undocumented Wisconsinites would not be that real ID. It would not be a federal ID. It would not do for voting. It would not do for those purposes that the law was passed. It would only be a driving license. But as we've seen, many other states have already taken this approach to solving the problem, and it has solved all kinds of problems and given an enormous number of benefits. Like Martin says, you know, having our court system clogged up with people who end up with convictions for driving without a license, when in fact they're not able to apply for a license, means that those structures are not able to focus on the real members of our community who need sanctioning for driving without a license. We need to just clear out all of this mess and give driver's licenses to all the people who otherwise should be able to drive in Wisconsin. It will make us all safer. It will generate a lot of state revenue. It will calm down our families and allow them to be much more productive members of our community. At this juncture, we are not in a position to solve the whole immigration nightmare that is our immigration system. But this is one small piece of the problem that we as Wisconsinites can solve, and we can solve it right now.
Is this proposal going to be seeing the light of day soon? I mean, is this being actively debated at the moment? What kind of timeline are we looking at?
I'm pleased to tell you that the proposal is in the state budget that Governor Evers has already issued. It is being debated by the Joint Finance Committee right now in Madison. And if it makes it through committee, then it will go to the floor. So if you are persuaded by these arguments, we urge you to get in touch with your state representatives and let them know that you also are in favor of finding this solution to this part of the problem.
Dr. Stephanie Mitchell is a professor of history at Carthage College, and also joining us today, Petula Walsh Grant, junior psychology and history major, and Kaya Martin, sophomore criminal justice and political science major. Thank you for joining us today on the morning show to share your thoughts and perspective on this really important issue. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this portion of The Morning Show, I am deeply honored to be speaking with one of America's most prolific and honored authors. His name is Martin W. Sandler, with over 70 books to his credit, five Emmy Awards on his shelf, and the author most recently of a book that won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. It is called 1919, The Year That Changed America. And in this book, Martin Sandler looks back 100 years to an America, much like today, deeply divided, troubled in many, many respects, and yet on the brink of exciting possibilities, but so much fear and unrest in the air as well. It's a beautifully constructed book, and I'm very, very pleased to be able to speak with Martin Sandler about it for the next few minutes. Again, the book titled 1919, The Year That Changed America. Martin Sandler, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, and that's a wonderful summary. Thank you.
I want to ask you, first of all, about the interesting challenge of writing specifically for young readers. And that's not what you exclusively do, but you do a lot of that, and you obviously do it extremely well. I wonder what goes through your mind as the author, as you are, for instance, choosing your words or structuring your books when you want to be sure that you are connecting with young readers. What is most important to you?
Well, I'm going to tell you a quick story, if I may. You know, I write about half my books for adults and half my books for young adults. And when I go on book tours, I speak at night to the adults. But during the day, I ask them to put me in the schools, and they always bring the whole school together. And they always ask me the same questions, and that is, you know, what's it like to write a book? What's it like to be famous? How old are you anyway? And well, I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and this fourth grader, this small fourth grader, raises her hand. And I say, yes, dear, what's your question? She said, can you identify any recurring theme that runs throughout the body of your work? So, you know, I mean, I never write down. Kids are so much smarter than we think they are. They are so much perceptive. Most of my books for young adults sell as well for adults as well. You know, the other thing that's happened in our recent lifetime is that I was told always, kids really don't like to read. Kids don't read a lot. And along comes J.K. Rowling, and kids are skipping school, or they're not going out on the playgrounds, or they're not playing football because they're home reading 110-page books. So I don't see a heck of a lot of difference in my writing style for either, because I just find that they're perceptive and more perceptive than we think they are.
Hmm. In a interview that you did, I think for a Boston radio station that I had the pleasure of eavesdropping on, let's say, you talked at one point basically in the same sentence about going for the magic and being careful to be accurate. And I just thought that was really interesting that an author would be talking about, in a sense, making magic, and in the same breath talking about being sure you're accurate. But I wonder if you could kind of talk about how those...
Tell you got to be accurate. I mean, you know, we're historians, you know. I mean, you have no idea how many times I'd love to embellish. I do it in my personal life all the time. You know, you make the story really fun. Make the story really magical. And you know, we're historians, and we're writing nonfiction. But the other thing I have to tell you is what I've learned. I was really had that dilemma early on, or at least I used to moan about it. I don't anymore, because what I've discovered is that if it's written right, if it's researched right, nonfiction is a hell of a lot more interesting than fiction, because it's true, and the true stories are even greater than anything. Now, sometimes when I've been digging out stuff in libraries or on the net and so forth, and I'm looking at my colleagues who are writing fiction, and all they have to do is have their head and their pen and their paper, I envy them. But nah, it doesn't last, because the stuff is out there, and there are incredible stories to be told that are true, that make that fiction pales in comparison to.
Your book,
but
19...
That's a good point you have, because yeah. That's right. I'm going for the magic. I want to hold on to that audience. I want to make them enjoy reading. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things that just thrilled me so much, or I'm so appreciative of in winning this National Book Award, it's the first time, to my knowledge, that a nonfiction book has won in that young people's literature category. And that these judges, for the first time, couldn't see that history can be not only as important, but as exciting and interesting to kids as nonfiction. That's to their credit, and I benefited from it, but it's to their credit, and I'm most appreciative of that.
We're speaking with Martin Sandler about his newest book, which is called 1919, The Year That Changed America. Speaking of amazing stories, this book starts with an amazing story, and one that I would suspect most of us have never heard anything about. And maybe if one lives in Boston and knows the history of that city, even then, I'm not sure how many current Bostonians know about the Great Molasses Flood of 1919. Tell our listeners a little bit about this and why you wanted to start the book with this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wanted to start the book with that because chronologically, it starts the year off. It's on January 15th, and it says, hey, maybe this is going to be kind of a special year. But it's interesting. When you first hear the story, you laugh. Then when you realize how many people died and that the entire elevated railroad system was destroyed in the North End and two Boston firehouses floated or were crushed and sent into the sea, then you realize that isn't funny. And very briefly, the story is that, you know, the war is about to come to an end, World War One. Prohibition is imminent. And so these alcohol companies realize, oh, my God, because believe it or not, molasses is a key ingredient in explosives. And, of course, it's the key ingredient in rum. And so they threw up this tank with no engineers to supervise it, with no blueprints, with just a bunch of hack contractors and mechanical or carpenter, whatever you call them, and they threw it up. It leaked from the beginning, and then when the weather changed dramatically one night and there was this amazing contraction, it exploded, and a 45-foot wave, I know that's hard to believe, of molasses came roaring down the street and demolished everything in front of it, including human life, so that it's the Great Molasses Flood of 1919. And it's known in Boston. A lot of myths have grown up about it, the biggest one being that today, on a hot day in July, if you walk around the North End, you can still smell the molasses coming up through the cracks of the cobblestone streets. That's not true. But you don't need any myths, because it's an extraordinary, extraordinary story. What's important about, there are two things, but that's what's important about this book, I think. There's two things about that. One, even from that story, there are important lessons were learned. For example, Boston and the United States didn't have one building code until that happened. Out of that comes the first building codes, the first laws that say if you're going to build up any kind of structure, you've got to have engineers, you've got to have blueprints, and the government has got to approve of it. That's a very important point, you know. So that the other thing, as I did my research, and, you know, when you're doing nonfiction, it's all about the research. When I was doing my research, I was startled to find that while there were policemen and firemen and Red Cross workers digging through the rubble, trying desperately to find any survivors of this catastrophe, all of the church bells in Boston started ringing joyously. And so what was that all about? And what I discovered was it's because on that very moment, the last state needed to pass prohibition had passed it. And so they were the proponents of prohibition were celebrating. So it's all connected. I mean, the same guy, out of the prohibition comes a whole new American character called the gangster, which I think that story, I think, is the most fun story in the whole book. But out of it comes the American gangster. But it's the same guys, same exact people who fund the Black Sox scandal in which the White Sox throw the World Series later that year. So there are just connections throughout, which make it very important.
Right. I think it's really important to, and particularly for young readers, but really for readers of any age, to understand just how much fear was in the air in 1919, particularly...
Good for you. These, that's exactly right.
Especially these things called Red Scares. So much fear of communism. And you trace a lot of this also to not so much a fear of communism. I mean, that was there, but... But anti-immigrant prejudice that was really at the heart of so much of that. Yeah. How serious was this in 1919?
Well, you couldn't have been more serious. It could not, you know, ultimately it leads to things like the Sacco Vanzetti when two innocent guys get executed. But there was, first of all, you have the Bolshevik Revolution just before this. And so now there are millions of people in America are convinced that the communists are now going to come over here and take over this government the way they took over Russia. And, of course, that all has to do with these immigrants. And the immigrants look different and smell different and dress different. And there's this whole incredible anti-immigrant, which it actually started years before when this first extraordinary wave of immigration began in, like, 1912. But anyway... It's an enormous scare, and it's really for those of us old enough to remember the McCarthy era. It's the precursor to the Joe McCarthy era. This guy Palmer, who was the Attorney General of the United States, he starts conducting raids and throwing. You know, McCarthy was infamous for holding up a blank piece of paper that nobody knew was blank, and said, "I have on this sheet the names of 200 people in our government who are communists." You know, there was nothing on the paper. Palmer is arresting people because they're immigrants. In fact, he's raiding immigrant halls and immigrant recreation facilities, throwing them in jail. He's actually deporting people. It's not a very nice period in American history for that score. But again, I have to say that in the end, he's found out. In the end, justice does prevail. But man, I mean, one of the things I say in the beginning of the book is that, you have to understand that progress is never a straight line. We're going through some very hard times today. We'll come out of it. But, man, when you're living through it, it doesn't seem it will happen, and it sure as hell doesn't, even though you can, a historian like me can pontificate and say, don't worry, progress is never a straight line. Try living through it and being happy about it.
Right. One of the things you say is that for all of the terrible things that occur in 1919, one also has a sense that ultimately good came from them. You've already touched on that with the great molasses flood, and I'm thinking too of some of the ways in which some of the terrible incidents of racial violence, of violence done against blacks, in some ways was the seed for the civil rights movement, which of course would ultimately not take off until decades later. But I mean, the seed was planted.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, good, very good observation. Exactly. And the NAACP is born. And in Washington, there were three main bedrocks of all these terrible incidents. One was in Chicago, one was in Washington, D.C., and one was in Arkansas. But in Washington, it's the first time that African Americans band together and start fighting back physically. So it's the first time you start to get organized opposition to, we're not going to lie down, we're not going to take it anymore. So you're absolutely right. It's true. Yeah, there's a lot to celebrate in that period. I mean, in this era. You know, even with the Black Sox scandal, I mean, those of us who love sports and read about how a team could throw the World Series, but out of it comes the first sanctions and the first laws, and it ain't going to happen again.
So. Mm. We also, of course, point with pride to the fact that 1919 is finally when women are on the brink of finally receiving the vote.
Right.
What do you think is most important for both men and women in 2019 to understand about that long struggle and that struggle finally succeeding?
Well, what I came up with, what my research showed and what I wrote about, was that after decades and decades and decades of this fighting, it was the abuse women took when they finally got organized that finally turned the tide. I mean, most of the country did not know what was going on. I mean, first of all, the prejudices were absolutely amazing. I mean, it was absolutely commonly believed by men that women were so frail in mind and body that if they were given the vote, they would go into the ballot box and start to make a decision and be so overwhelmed they'd faint right in the ballot box. Now, the interesting thing that most people don't know about is that in the western territories of Colorado and Wyoming, women had the vote. Women had gotten the vote decades before this. And why? Because they're out in the fields working side by side with the men. The men need them. And also the men are physically observing that women are every bit as strong and probably a little smarter than the men. But now nationwide, there's still this thing. But what happens is women finally, under a couple of incredible leaders, particularly a woman named Alice Paul, who's, I think, a very much neglected heroine in this country. We hear about Katie Stanton, and we hear about a lot of people. We don't hear a lot about Alice Paul. She's the hero. And she organizes the first great march. And what happens? The great march in Washington, men attack the marchers, and they beat them up. And the police come, and they arrest the women. And they put them in jail, and so the women go on hunger strikes. And suddenly the newspapers pick it up, and they understand that the women are starving. And women are being force-fed through their nostrils. I mean, they're being abused. And then there are other strikes. And again, women are thrown in jail. And again, they do that. And it's finally when the rest of the country starts seeing the abuse women are willing to take in order to get what they know is their right, that it turns around. And they get the vote. And, you know, if you ask what's the most, it's very hard to pick out what's the most important thing. It probably, if you had to vote, I would say that's probably more. But, you know, you look at Prohibition and you look at all these other things that happened, and you look at the fact that there were more labor strikes, again, having to do with anti-immigration policies, but there were more labor strikes in 1919 than has ever occurred in the United States. And out of it comes the President of the United States. I mean, there's some cool stuff going on. I mean, the Boston police strike takes place. It's the first time that a government agency, workers of a government agency, have struck against the government. And you've got a governor of Massachusetts named Calvin Coolidge who deals with the problem by running away. He doesn't want to touch it. But before he runs, he makes one statement. He says, there's never any right for anyone to strike against the government at any time. And it becomes a catchword for all those around the country, and it makes him President of the United States. I mean, you couldn't make up a lot of these things that happened in this
right.
year.
And, of course, you tell us that this is a year full of incredible events, and they're all hooked together. They're each linked. They
yep.
each affect the other. You say what may have looked like separate events were all evidence of seismic and systemic social change. The book, again, is 1919, The Year That Changed America. It's published by Bloomsbury, and it's award-winning author Martin Sandler. Martin Sandler, you've done it again with a marvelous book, and I'm really glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Well, I am too, and thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, several different interviews, including one with the author of a book called Chronic, which looks at what the author regards as a pandemic of chronic autoimmune disease in the United States. On Thursday, Elinette Binder and her beautiful novel, The Vanishing Sky, which focuses on a German family in the waning months of the Second World War, trying to hold it together as their nation disintegrates around them. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8